All right, let's dive in. You guys wanted to unpack 2 Samuel 12. It's a wild chapter full of drama, consequences, all that good stuff. We've got Dr. Chisholm's lectures on 1 and 2 Samuel to help us out. So think of this as a deep dive into ancient justice with some seriously flawed characters. Remember last time we were in chapter 11?
Yeah.
David, Bathsheba, Uriah.
Yeah, David's really messed up.
Yeah, things are about to get messy.
It's interesting how this chapter doesn't just start with David, like, immediately repenting or, you know, trying to fix things. Mm-hmm. It's God who sends the prophet Nathan to confront him. And, you know, Nathan doesn't just barge in there and start accusing David.
Right.
Dr. Chisholm points this out. Nathan uses a parable, a story with a hidden message, to really kind of expose David's sin without, like, directly accusing him.
Oh, it's clever. It's like a psychological trap. You get the listener, you know, totally invested in the story before dropping the truth bomb.
Exactly.
So what's this parable all about? What's the story?
Okay, so Nathan tells David a story about these two men. One's rich and one's poor. The poor man, he has this one little ewe lamb. He loves this lamb. It's like family to him. The rich man, though, he's got tons of flocks, right?
Right.
But when a guest shows up, instead of, you know, being hospitable and using his own resources, he steals the poor man's lamb and slaughters it.
Oh, man. Yeah. That is cold.
It's brutal.
Definitely not winning any good neighbor awards there.
No.
So David, with his strong sense of justice, you know, how does he react?
He falls right into Nathan's trap. David, he's outraged. He's like, that rich man, he deserves to die. He should repay the poor man like 4 times over.
Fourfold. Wow.
Yeah, this concept of fourfold restitution, it's a key thing here.
Yeah.
In ancient Israelite law, you know, if you stole something, you didn't just give it back. You had to pay back 4 times its value. It's like a major consequence, you know, to make people think twice before they mess with someone else's stuff.
So David, without even knowing it, basically sets the bar super high for his own punishment.
Right.
But how does Nathan reveal that David is actually, he is the rich man in this story?
It's a powerful moment. Nathan looks David right in the eye and he's just like, you are the man.
Oh.
It's like a total reality check.
Yeah.
Then he reminds David about all the blessings God has given him, the kingship, his dynasty, the victories in battle. You know, it's as if Nathan is saying, look at everything God has done for you. And this is how you repay him, by taking what's not yours and covering it up with violence.
Oof. That's got to hurt.
Yeah.
It's not just about the crime itself. It's about this violation of trust, this relationship with God.
Exactly. And Dr. Chisholm, he connects this back to the covenant God made with David, mm-hmm. you know, promising a dynasty, all that. But that promise wasn't a blank check. It came with responsibility. And David's options show that he's basically disregarding God's authority in the sanctity of that covenant.
You know, this whole situation, it reminds me of Eli's sons back in Judges.
Oh, yeah.
They were priests who used their position for personal gain, you know, totally disrespecting God. And then there's King Saul. He disobeyed God, and that led to his downfall.
Right, right.
It's like David's following in their footsteps, repeating these same mistakes.
Those comparisons, they're important because they highlight how serious David's sin is. Mm. You know, he's not just messing up personally, but he's setting this terrible example. He's the king. He's supposed to be the leader of God's chosen people.
Right. He's supposed to be leading by example.
It shows that even the people closest to God can still stumble.
Yeah.
And when they do, there are serious consequences.
Yeah. But here's the thing. David, he owns up to it.
He does.
Right away. He doesn't make excuses. He doesn't try to shift blame. He just says, I have sinned against the Lord.
It's a powerful moment of genuine confession.
Yeah.
And Nathan, he assures David, you know, the Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die.
Okay, so wait, does that mean everything goes back to normal? Like, case closed?
Yeah.
All forgiven?
Not so fast. This is where it gets interesting. We have to remember, forgiveness in the Old Testament, it doesn't always mean a completely clean slate.
Oh, interesting.
Sometimes, as Dr. Chisholm explains, it's like a reduced sentence.
Hmm.
God's justice still needs to be satisfied.
Hmm.
And that satisfaction, it comes at a cost.
Right.
And often, a really heartbreaking one.
So what happens? How does this all play out?
Nathan delivers some pretty devastating news to David.
Okay.
He tells him that the son born to him and Bathsheba will die. This is the first part of that fourfold restitution that David himself called for earlier in the parable.
Oh, wow.
The consequences of his actions, they're going to affect everyone around him.
This is heavy stuff. So how does David react?
He's desperate. He pleads with God. He fasts. He mourns.
He's trying everything he can to change God's mind.
It really shows us the human cost of sin. You know, it's not some abstract idea. It has real consequences that affect everyone.
So what happens next?
Well, on the seventh day, the child dies. David's servants, they're afraid to even tell him.
Yeah, they're probably thinking he's going to completely lose it.
Exactly. But when they confirm the child's death, David's reaction is, well, it's unexpected.
Oh.
Instead of falling apart, he gets up, he washes himself, he changes his clothes, and he goes to worship.
Wow.
He goes to the house of the Lord.
That's a powerful response. What do you think it means?
It's complex, but I think it shows a lot about David's faith. He's obviously devastated.
Yeah.
But he also recognizes that God is in control.
Yeah.
He understands there's a limit to what humans can do. He chooses to turn to God, not in defiance, but in surrender.
His servants must have been really confused.
Oh, they were. They even asked him, you know, why are you acting this way? You fasted and wept when he was alive, but now you just get up and eat.
Yeah. What does he say to that?
David explains that while the child was still alive, there was hope, a chance that God might change his mind.
Right.
But now that God's decree has happened, mourning wouldn't change anything.
Right. He's accepting it.
He knows he can't bring the child back, and so he chooses to move forward, painful as it is.
It's a powerful testament to his faith, even in the face of such a huge loss.
Exactly.
He tells his servants, I will go to him, but he will not return to me.
That's right.
What a stark statement about the finality of death. Makes me wonder what David's view of the afterlife was like back then.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
It's something Dr. Chisholm talks about.
Okay.
The ancient Israelites didn't have the same idea of heaven and hell that we might have today. Their idea of the afterlife was more about Sheol.
Sheol?
A shadowy place of silence where everyone went after death.
So for David, it wasn't so much about where the child went, but the fact that he was gone.
And nothing could change that.
That's a powerful realization.
It really is. And then we see this tender moment where David comforts Bathsheba.
Oh, yeah.
Even in the midst of all this judgment and consequences, there's still room for love and compassion.
That's beautiful. And then there's a bit of hope, right? Bathsheba has another son.
She does.
And they name him Solomon.
Yes.
And the text specifically tells us that the Lord loved him.
It's a powerful statement.
Yeah.
And to make it even more clear, God sends Nathan to give Solomon a second name, Jedidiah.
Jedidiah.
Which means beloved of the Lord.
Oh, wow.
This child, born out of tragedy, he becomes a symbol of hope.
Yeah.
God is still faithful to his promises. Even though David sinned, God is still committed to him and his dynasty.
That's really important.
It is.
God's love and mercy, it's not based on our perfection. He can bring good things out of even the darkest situations.
Absolutely. But we can't forget that sword hanging over David's house.
Right.
This is just the first part of that fourfold restitution. There's more to come. In the meantime, we shift back to the battlefield. Remember Joab, David's general?
Yeah, he's been left to deal with the Ammonites.
That's right. He sends a message to David, urging him to come and finish the job so the victory can be attributed to him, not Joab. It's almost like he's saying, hey, David, get back to work. There's a kingdom to run.
So David's back on the battlefield, back in control. But this is just the beginning.
It is.
Three more installments left to pay. What do you think those will be?
That's a question we'll explore as we keep going with 2 Samuel.
Yeah.
But I'll leave you with this. The consequences of David's sin aren't just about punishment. They're also about restoration.
Restoration.
It's like a wound that needs to heal.
Mm.
It can be messy and painful, but ultimately it's about God's faithfulness and his desire to bring good even out of our mistakes.
So much to think about. Stay tuned for part 2, where we'll uncover even more twists and turns in this epic saga.
It's going to get even more intense.
Buckle up, folks.
So we left off with David back in charge, leading his army to victory. But as we get into the next part of 2 Samuel 12, things get complicated.
Yeah.
Those consequences we talked about, they start to hit home and it gets pretty rough.
Yeah. Chapter 12 ends with, you know, a sense of victory. But then chapter 13.
Right.
It takes a dark turn. It's that sword never departing from his house prophecy. Right. And this time it's not some battle on a distant field. It's happening right in David's own family.
Exactly. Dr. Chisholm points out that how chapter 13 starts,
mm-hmm.
it's like it's contrasting the victory from chapter 12 with this like moral failure. It's heavy stuff.
So the key players here are Amnon and Absalom, two of David's sons. And this is a tough story, guys. Amnon, he becomes obsessed with his half-sister Tamar.
It's not just attraction. The text is very clear. It's this consuming lust that drives him to do something horrific.
Yeah, it's awful. He assaults her. And the way he treats her afterward, it's just as cruel as the assault itself. It's just, it's a reminder of how devastating sexual violence is.
Dr. Chisholm is very careful to emphasize the importance of reading this passage with sensitivity. He also points out the parallels between Amnon's actions and
Bathsheba. Of his own actions.
Yeah, with Bathsheba. Yeah. It's like, David's sin has planted the seed, and now we're seeing the fruit, and it's rotten.
And the tragedy keeps unfolding. Tamar's brother, Absalom, he finds out what Amnon did, and
he's furious.
He wants revenge.
But he waits. 2 years. He's planning, plotting.
Yeah, 2 years of simmering rage.
It speaks to this idea of honor and shame that was so important in their culture back then.
It also creates this tension, right? You know something terrible is going to happen, but you don't know when.
It's like a ticking time bomb.
And it also mirrors David's actions, right? Remember how he tried to cover up his sin with Bathsheba? Now, Absalom is consumed by this desire for vengeance. It's a cycle of deceit and violence.
Exactly. And that cycle, it explodes during a sheep shearing festival. Absalom invites all of David's sons to a feast, including Amnon.
Yeah.
And during the celebration, Absalom's servants, they kill Amnon, cold blood.
Wow. Shocking, but also kind of predictable.
It is. It's a consequence of Amnon's actions, but it also shows how broken David's family has become.
So David, he finds out about Amnon's death and he's devastated. But I imagine it's complicated, right? Because deep down, he knew Amnon deserved some kind of punishment for what he did to Tamar.
Exactly. This is where it gets really complex. David is the king. He's supposed to uphold justice. But he's also a father who just lost his son.
It's a tough situation.
And it reminds us that sin always has consequences. Not just for the person who sins, but for everyone around them.
Yeah, like a ripple effect.
Exactly. And those ripples, they don't stop there. Absalom, he's afraid of what David might do, so he runs away. He goes into exile for 3 years.
So now David has lost two sons, one to death and one to exile.
And Dr. Chisholm suggests that this separation from Absalom, it's part of that fourfold restitution.
Oh, interesting. It's like another layer of punishment. Not just losing a child, but also the relationship.
Exactly. But remember, God's justice isn't just about punishment. It's also about restoration. It's a long process.
So we end this part of our deep dive with David grieving. His family is shattered, his kingdom is unstable, and his past is haunting him.
And remember, we're only at 2 out of 4. There's still more consequences to come. And as we move into the next chapter, things get even more intense.
This is getting good. Stay tuned to see how it all unfolds. So we've seen the devastating consequences of David's sin. First, the death of his child, and then the awful things with Amnon and Absalom.
Yeah.
Now, in 2 Samuel 14, David's grappling with all the fallout. He's lost one son, and another one's in exile. Where do we go from here?
This is where things get really interesting. Mm-hmm. We see this, like, intricate bands between justice, mercy, and politics as David really wants Absalom back, but he's stuck, right? Yeah. He has to uphold the law, you know?
It's a tough spot. He's heartbroken, but bringing Absalom back isn't simple. The guy committed murder.
Exactly. And David's advisors, especially Joab.
Oh, Joab.
He sees a chance to manipulate the situation.
Always working behind the scenes, that guy. What's he up to this time?
Well, he knows how badly David wants Absalom back, but he's hesitant to, you know, just do it openly. So Joab comes up with this plan.
Okay.
He finds this wise woman from Tekoa and tells her to present a made-up case to David.
A fictional case? What kind of case?
It's a story about her two sons. One killed the other in a fight, and now her family wants her remaining son executed, you know, for justice. It's a plea for mercy designed to really tug at David's heartstrings.
Oh, wow. So it's like a parable within a parable.
Exactly.
Pretty clever.
Yeah.
How does David respond to this woman's story?
He's moved. He's compassionate. He assures her that her son will be safe. He even implies that he has the power to, like, stop any more bloodshed in this situation.
Uh-oh. I think I see where this is going.
Right. Joab's plan kicks in. He instructs the woman to point out how inconsistent David's being.
Yeah, she's going to call him out for showing mercy in this fake story, but not for his own son.
Exactly. It's brilliant. He's forced to confront his own hypocrisy, admit how much he misses Absalom. He can't argue with his own logic.
So does this mean Absalom gets a hero's welcome back in Jerusalem?
Not quite. David lets him come back, but he has to live in isolation for 2 years.
2 years? That doesn't seem like much punishment for, you know, killing your brother.
That's a good point. And Dr. Chisholm suggests that this lenient sentence, it's a flaw in David's leadership.
Oh, interesting.
He's letting his feelings get in the way of justice. It's setting a bad example.
Yeah.
You know, and it's going to lead to more trouble down the road.
Because we know Absalom doesn't exactly have a reputation for being patient.
Right. During those 2 years, he's just stewing, plotting. He starts undermining David, making himself look like the better leader.
It's like a slow motion coup.
Exactly. And eventually, he launches a full-blown rebellion. David has to flee Jerusalem. It's this huge betrayal, and it all stems from David not properly addressing Absalom's crime and his own guilt.
So that sword that was never supposed to leave his house, it comes back to haunt him in the form of his own son. It's like poetic justice.
And so, a chilling fulfillment of Nathan's prophecy. David's sin, even though God forgave him, it has these long-lasting consequences. More bloodshed, division, the loss of his kingdom.
Man, this whole story has been intense. It makes you wonder, could any of this have been prevented?
That's the question Dr. Chisholm asks. While David's sin with Bathsheba started this chain of events, his later choices, especially with Absalom, they made it worse.
It shows that even with forgiveness, our choices still matter. And sometimes trying to hide things or avoid consequences, it can backfire.
Yeah, this story is so powerful because it's so honest about human nature. Even the people closest to God mess up. But it also shows God's mercy. Even when we make huge mistakes, God is still there. He wants to redeem us.
So what does this ancient story have to do with us today?
I think it gives us real insight into sin, justice, and forgiveness. It shows us that our choices have consequences, but also offers hope. Even when we fail, God's grace is bigger than our mistakes.
It's a story that encourages us to look at ourselves, to deal with our own issues, and to seek forgiveness, knowing that God is always there for us.
And it reminds us to think about how our actions affect others. Our choices can have a big impact, so we need to act with integrity and responsibility.
Well, there you have it, our deep dive into 2 Samuel 12. Sin, justice, mercy, family drama, political intrigue. It's been a wild ride.
Dr. Chisholm's lectures go even deeper into all these themes, so I definitely recommend checking those out.
Absolutely. And as you think about this story, bring your own experiences and questions to it. What speaks to you? What challenges you? Let this ancient text guide you on your own journey.
Until next time, keep exploring and keep diving deep.